Welcome to In the Studio, now in our 30th consecutive year, with the first person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train, and today in the studio, it's the 40th anniversary of Dire Straits.
In the shadow of the cargoes, I take you one time, while counting all the numbers down to the waterline. Water of love, deep in the ground, but there ain't no water here to be found. Someday, baby, when the river runs free, it's gonna carry that water of love to me. With the Sultan.
There was nobody in the pub except the little band, the Dixie 9 Jazz Band on the stage, and a bunch of kids playing pool in the corner who weren't the slightest bit interested in the band. So that's it. Because they're playing it to an empty pub, there's something great about it, the fact that they're just there and they're doing it because they love it. So that's their way of liberating themselves, if you like. That's their way of finding their, getting their kick.
We are the Sultans of Swing.
Hello, I'm Mark Knopfler in the studio for the making of the first Dire Straits album.
Late 1978 was a curious time for popular music. If you look at the sales charts then, soundtracks from Saturday Night Fever and Grease dominated the pop charts. But the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, Elvis Costello, Talking Heads, and the Cars, they'd all bumped rock's establishment, such as the Stones, the Who, and Led Zeppelin, off of the front page of the music magazines and off center stage. Formed in the tough South London district in 1977, the band Dire Straits was led by a then 27-year-old former college English professor by the name of Mark Knopfler. Scottish-born, English-raised, Knopfler had also spent 3 years writing for a newspaper in Leeds. Dire Straits was a direct outgrowth of the roots revivalism of pub rock, writes Stephen Thomas Erlewine on AllMusic.com. But where pub rock celebrated good times, Dire Straits were melancholy. And while the bar band mentality of pub rock is at the core of Dire Straits, their music is already beyond the simple boogie and shuffles of their forefathers, end quote. Dire Straits was built around their songwriter frontman Mark Knopfler, who possessed a distinctive guitar sound that's remained immediately identifiable to this day. Knopfler's lyrics were literary and often Dylan-esque, while Mark Knopfler's rich baritone voice, neither elite nor effete, was fitting for a street corner minstrel. In the studio, Mark Knopfler had no difficulty recalling childhood memories of music.
Well, the best one is that my Uncle Kingsley played the boogie-woogie piano. And when I was just a handful of years old, I heard him playing boogie-woogie. And I hadn't heard the blues or rock and roll. I didn't know really what it was at all. So when I'd probably heard things on the radio when I was a little kid, like the Runaway Train or whatever, but I didn't know. You know, I didn't really know it, what it was as a form. And when I heard that boogie woogie, what I was hearing was the blues and rock and roll. And it was so delicious to me. These three chords, the logic of it, these great blocks of logic banged into place. And I thought, this is for me. This is this is it. And I still feel the joy of boogie. You know, that to me, I mean, if I pick up a guitar now, that's really what I play. My rhythm guitar playing, that's what it's all about. That my thumb, my picking, that's what the whole thing's about, playing on two strings. And when I hear something like Albert Amon's playing Shout for Joy, you know, that's exactly what it is. That is it for me. That is great music. I still love to hear music, that kind of music. I mean, I still love, if I wanted to recharge, you know, or you hear Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf or something, that's a great reach, it's a great charge for me.
Sweet surrender on the quayside. You remember we used to run high.
shadow of the car goes, I'll take you one time. We're counting all the numbers down to the waterline. When neon misses on the dog-eared stairway, friends kisses in the darkest doorway. Fog home. Shoulder. Up comes a coaster, fast and silent in the night. Over my shoulder, all you can see are the and her jeans are torn. Your hands are cold, but your lips are warm.
Once Mark Knopfler had gotten a taste of boogie-woogie music from Uncle Kingsley, he became downright insatiable, and though he would eventually gain recognition as one of the finest guitarists of our time, that wasn't the instrument that Mark first picked up.
It started on tennis rackets. They tried to teach me piano when I was six, and I would just play it by ear. I'd hear the little exercise and then just play it by ear, so that reading the music was always going to be a problem for me, so I left that. Parents tried me on violin at school too, because they wouldn't get me a guitar. And I just wanted to play guitar. And the violin was the same thing, and the music, I could play the thing and get good notes out of it, had a good vibrato and everything. But the reading was a problem. And I had to wait until I was 15 before I got a hold of a guitar. And I was so desperate. It had to be red, it had to be electric. And it was a stretch for Dad. It was 50 quid. It was a big stretch for Dad. And, all his money was going on paying the mortgage and feeding the family. So there wasn't a lot of spare cash around. But anyway, it was quite a stretch for him. And he realized that I was desperate in the end and took me out and bought this thing. And I haven't even bought it. I didn't have the nerve to ask him for an amplifier. So I blew up the family radio. And down at night, after they'd gone to bed, and I used to stick my head on the guitar to make it louder. I would stick the head of the guitar on the arm of the wooden arm of the chair to try and get some amplification out of it. I had to wait a long time. And then because I didn't have the money for an amplifier, I used to borrow friends' acoustics and started playing in acoustic guitar, which I always have. And if I go home now, I'll play an acoustic. I started playing in folk joints because I learned how to. After, I'd done all the Everly Brothers strumming and my little friend Vince was Don and I was Phil, and or the other way around, actually, I think it was, because he had a higher voice than me. I learned how to finger pick, but all the time wanting to play rock and roll, all the time, being envious of the kids with the amplifiers. So I developed on two lines, one the acoustic picking and then the other one with the picking in, and learning the electric guitar without an amplifier, or just going around to a friend's house who had one where I could plug it in.
Harry made a bareback rider, proud and free upon a horse. And a fine coal miner for the NCB that was. A fallen angel, should have seen her knew the skater's walls. Some people, they got to paint and draw. Harry had to work in clay and stone. Like the waves coming to the shore, and in Leeds. He might as well have been making toys. Strings of beads, it couldn't be. No, it couldn't be. In the gallery, he doesn't want to paint at all. He takes an empty canvas, sticks it on the wall. Burns off a fella, all the phonies and all of the fakes. While the dealers, they get together, then they decide who gets the breaks. Who's gonna be? Who's gonna be in the gallery? Yeah. In the gallery. In the coming down from the tree, he's gonna be.
Dire Straits from their debut in autumn 1978 with the Mark Knopfler song In the Gallery, lamenting the curious, some might say even cruel, tendency for so many fine artists to go unrecognized and unappreciated until after they're gone. Up next, Mark Knopfler meets Dire Straits bass player John Ilsley fast asleep. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Mark Knopfler in the studio for the 40th anniversary of the debut album from Dire Straits.
Hello, I'm Mark Knopfler in the studio for the making of the first Dire Straits album.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Redbeard, and together we're recalling the dreams realized and the hurdles cleared in fall 1978, resulting in the first Dire Straits album, which has sold an estimated 10 million copies worldwide. Mark Knopfler admits to making a questionable first impression when meeting future Dire Straits bass player John Ilsley through Mark's younger brother, David Knopfler.
John and David were living in a hovel in a sort of a condemned block of ancient Victorian flats down in Deptford, which is the armpit of South London. And there were a lot of students and people who would live in these places where normal families would have nothing to do with. And they were all living there. And I went down there and I wanted to get the band together with, and I wanted David, and I wanted to try and get the band together. I was sleeping on the floor. What happens when you play on a sofa is you start to play and then you start to slide down towards the floor as the hours go by. You learn to play flat on your back eventually and you fall asleep playing. I used to fall asleep playing. And you can drool and so on and so forth. But anyway, you end up on the floor, and a cushion sometimes goes with you, which is something of a benefit. And John, he's a big, tall guy, came in the door in the morning. He'd been out all night. He came in about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, or whatever it was. And that's how he met me with a fast asleep with a guitar.
High and dry in the long, hot day. Lost and lonely everywhere. All around, sky up above. Yes, I need a little water of love. I've been too long lonely and my heart feels pain. Crying out. Yes, I need a little water of love. Water of love, deep in the ground. But there ain't no water here to be found. Someday, baby, when the river runs free, gonna carry that water of love to me. Thank you.
Being predominantly an instrument of the blues, the National Steel is pretty much indigenous to the American South. Though he taught himself to play bottleneck slide when he was young, Dire Straits guitarist Mark Knopfler didn't have the opportunity to play the National Steel until much later.
I didn't know about them then. That I didn't really know about country blues then. I was more interested in the electric side of things. I heard B.B. King when I was 15, and it shook me. It made a big impression on me. I got into the National Steels and all of that, and the country blues a bit later on when I went to Leeds to work, and I saw Steve Phillips playing in a blues club one night, and just introduced myself, got to know him, and then eventually picked up my own National, and we started to play together, and as the Duolian string pickers, and we'd play a couple of radio sessions and things, and that Steve's house was one of the colleges, if you like, where I learned a lot of early playing, if you like, and then learned about earlier bottleneck playing, earlier slide playing, and I'd play with thumb picks and steel finger picks and all of that, and went through all of that. I was never studious about, when I say college, it's actually not true. I never did a sort of an academic, it was never an academic approach to any of it. Steve would dissect the thing and be able to do it sort of note for note, and I wasn't really interested in doing that. I was more interested in just absorbing the spirit of it and moving on.
Following his second year as an English lit professor, Mark Knopfler scraped up enough money to take a vacation to America. Armed with only a knapsack and a Greyhound bus ticket, Mark began to understand his true calling during that trip. Returning to England, Knopfler tried to continue his teaching career, but his music would not, indeed, could not be denied.
Yeah, I was pushing hard. I was teaching then. I was teaching at the time in a college, which was great for me because I had more money than I ever earned before. You know, because teaching was, the college was, so Greg bought a motorcycle and everything. And I could ride down there and play. And the other thing was I could play at nights. I was playing rockabilly and R&B at nights. I was teaching during the day and playing in a band at night time. But my own songs were pushing real hard. I had a bunch of them by then, and they were pushing hard to be done. And I wanted to have a vehicle to do it. So I made it down to Deptford to see the boys, and we just got a little band going down there, a little four-piece, and just played there for a summer, rehearsed up there. But you really got to want to do it. You've got to, it was a lot of, well, there's a lot of willpower involved, if you know what I mean. You've really got to want to do it. I keep saying it, but boy, you wanted to do it pretty badly.
Stepping out to Angelou Chase for my coffee beans, checking out the movies and the magazines. A waitress, she watches me crossing from the Barracuda. I get a pickup for my steel guitar. I saw ya Chef's burying in you. Excuse me talking, I wanna marry you. This is 7 Heaven Street. Don't you seem so proud? Just another angel in the crowd. And a man's world on a
money go down. Duck inside the doorway. Duck to eat. Just ain't no way you and me. Yes, I saw the DJ, he say, "Here's man before you." Feel all right, seeing her do that stuff. She's dancing high and I'm moving by. The close-ups can get rough.
The lyrical imagery in several of the songs on this album, including this one, were often compared to Bob Dylan. Exceedingly lofty praise for a beginner. Here's Mark Knopfler.
But there's no formula to songwriting. I mean, some of them are like that. Other songs can be short, just a little thought. One of the things I love about songwriting is that it doesn't follow. There are no rules in terms of almost anything. They come for different reasons, and you can be in a situation, and you recognize some of the little song alarm goes off. Why it should do that, I really don't know. But and you can talk about those kind of songs. Other songs, they're much harder to explain. You know, it's a more nebulous thing, and sometimes the harder you try to explain them, the more you feel them getting away from you. And plus, there's always the danger that I'll spoil it for you, because you'll have your own idea of what it is for you.
After Mark Knopfler hooked up with his guitar-playing brother David and bass player John Ilsley, they hired session drummer Pick Withers, and the Dire Straits lineup was complete. Dubbed Dire Straits because of their pitiful financial status at the time, they initially failed to capture the attention of the British press, who were only interested in punk rock, it seems, at the time. Dire Straits did manage to get some of their music played on Radio London, which led directly to their first record deal. Again, Mark Knopfler.
There was a tremendous amount of record company interest at the beginning. Everybody knows all that story and what happened, but what they don't know is that, well, maybe they do, but a lot of these record companies, you know, they get involved in the interest in a band, and then because other record companies are interested, they pretend not to be interested, and then people start dropping out. And there was this big buzz going around London and everything because Charlie Gillett had played a demo, a few songs that were done on the radio and on Radio London. But the record companies were all turning up the gigs, but they were dropping out. They were dropping. And in fact, we'd given up the jobs, and it was kind of touch and go for a while. And then the last remaining company, who didn't know they were the last remaining company, we went with.
Southbound again. Don't know if I'm gonna leave and home. Boy,
placebo feeling. Every time I'm moving down the line,
picking on that guitar that would make Chet Atkins proud. That's Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits with Southbound Again from their 1978 debut. Still to come, the Cinderella hit of 1978 that took Dire Straits into the mainstream. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Mark Knopfler for the 40th anniversary of the first from Dire Straits.
Hello, I'm Mark Knopfler in the studio for the making of the first Dire Straits album.
Thanks again, Mark. I'm Redbeard. 1978 was a watershed year for blockbuster albums by superstars such as the Rolling Stones, Journeyman Ascendants, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Seger, and Billy Joel, as well as newcomers, Foreigner and Boston. And then there was a whole new crop of punk rock and so-called new wave bands led by the Ramones, Clash, Sex Pistols, and Talking Heads, really shaking things up. But when I think about the sound of the autumn and winter 1978, one song immediately echoes through all of it. Here, Mark Knopfler with me in the studio for the story behind Sultans of Swing.
It's exactly, pretty much exactly as the song says. Just a little pub in South London. Went out there with my brother for a drink and near the place where the hole in the wall where we were living, and there was nobody in the pub. Except the little band, the Dixieland Jazz Band on the stage, and a bunch of kids playing pool in the corner who weren't the slightest bit interested in the band. So that's it. That's because they're playing it to an empty pub. There's something great about the fact that they're just there and they're doing it because they love it. So that's their way of liberating themselves, if you like. That's their way of finding their, getting their kick. And to me, whenever I've seen anybody enjoying liberating themselves that way from whatever terrible situation, this terrible little pub that's pretty much empty, something attracts me to it. I'm attracted to it. I like it. I like people that take a minus situation and turn it into a plus situation.
You get a shiver in the dark. It's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many. In other places, but the horns
When I originally wrote Sultans, the music was completely different. I can't remember what it was now, but they were just straight chords on a National steel guitar. So the tune was different. When I got my Strat, I started to play the Strat. And because of the tool I was using, the song became something else. So and it's an example of, for example, if a songwriter sits down and plays a piano, if he can play a piano, then he'll write a different song than if he sits and plays a Hammond, or if he sits and plays a guitar. The song will be different because of the instrument that he plays. And that's an example of that.
That's Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits talking about the classic Sultans of Swing. Eventually, Dire Straits' debut hit number 2 on the American album charts, more than 9 million copies later. I asked Mark Knopfler how much Dire Straits' unique sound was responsible for their overall popularity initially.
I have no idea. I mean, so many people get into it for so many reasons. It hits people on so many levels that that you can't generalize about it. I think probably what resonates in me, reverberates around, probably because I'm the same as most people. I think that it just reverberates in them. Maybe just I have a channel whereby I can maybe get it down, and that's what it is. I love it when people write and say it helps them do things, it helps them paint or take photographs or whatever it is that they do. Novelists, people. It's amazing how many people. There's all sorts of, it comes from all sorts of areas. So it's not just always, it's not the one source. There's such a multiplicity of responses of different kinds. And I love it when the music gets used, markers in people's lives, and it gets used, it's on the shelf and it's being used. I enjoy that. Enjoy that whole side of it. And there's other things too. I mean, the live side, you're actually doing something positive. It's great when a guy tells you he's suicidal, he got drank along to the show, and now he's going on, he's feeling fine, and he's so inspired, and everything's going to be fine. So you actually feel as though you've actually performed some kind of social service. It was a great fun time. And the great thing about all these people, and over all the years as it's gone on, is to have had such great engineers working on the records, because these people make you sound better than you are. And it's sort of gone on like that. There was Neil Dorfman later on, and I learned a little bit from all of these people, and I wasn't conscious of trying to learn anything. I'm still not, just by being around them a little bit, you pick up little things here and there. And so that got me to a stage where I started to actually enjoy recording, more than I was. And I think that's gone on, where I kind of get more out of it now. Just the whole process of trying to get something, a performance recorded is, it's a lovely little art, I don't know very, I really honestly, I don't know very much about it. And I've tried to kind of keep it that way, with not try and get too in deep into it where it affects, slows down what I'm doing too much. But being lucky enough to work with such good engineers over the years, some of it rubs off, a little bit of it just rubs off here and there. And you learn from all of them, so it's been a great trip.
Anniversary of their 1978 debut, congratulations to Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Mark Knopfler. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.